Coming up in the next hour, the Transport Minister on the European Investment Bank's financial injection into the Lewis, the arrest of the anti-eviction activist Charles Allen Sr. We talked to the Irish Examiner journalist with the story, why the Bishop of Cork and Ross is distancing himself from comments made by one of the priests in his diocese at a funeral, and criticism of Extravision for telling pre-order customers of the €500 Xbox that they must spend even more money on a game. And there's more on those school league tables.
It's 8 o'clock on Tuesday, the 26th of November on RT Radio 1. You're listening to Morning Ireland with Christopher McKevitt and Cathal McCullough.
The headlines: figures show that the number of secondary schools from which all leaving certificate students progress to third level education is continuing to rise. The parties in the Syrian conflict have been asked to name their delegations by the end of December for new talks to try to end the war. And a mass vaccination programme is getting underway in the Philippines to immunise children affected by Typhoon Haiyan. The news in full from Clodagh Walsh.
The number of secondary schools from which all leaving certificate students progress to third level education is continuing to rise, according to the latest feeder school lists. They continue to show that pupils from fee-paying schools in Gaelscoileanna claim the vast majority of places with the highest points. The tables are based on data provided by over 30 third-level colleges about the schools attended by students who enrolled in 2013. Kate Carolyn reports.
The latest league tables revealed that non-fee-paying schools account for three-quarters of the top 100 schools sending students to third level. However, students from fee-paying schools and Gaelscoileanna claim the majority of places that have a high entry point requirement, such as medicine, dentistry and law. The tables also reveal that schools with high numbers of disadvantaged pupils send fewer students to college. The Teachers Union of Ireland have warned that the publication of school feeder lists risks distorting the true meaning of education. The union believes that inclusive schools, which embrace all learners in the local community, are unfairly represented by the focus on third-level progression.
The United Nations and Arab League Special Envoy to Syria, Latgar Brahimi, has asked the Syrian parties to name their delegations by the end of December for new talks to try to end the war. Yesterday, the UN announced that a new international effort to resolve the conflict would get underway in Geneva on January the 22nd. The United States has repeated that the goal of talks on the Syrian crisis should be the removal from power of President Bashar al-Assad and the formation of a transitional government. Meanwhile, a new report by a network of more than 60 human rights groups says that Syrian women are increasingly the targets of violent abuse and torture by government forces and armed groups. Based on interviews with victims and medical staff in the first half of the year, the report also concludes that women are increasingly being targeted by snipers and used as human shields, often with their children. A mass vaccination programme is getting underway in the Philippines to immunise children affected by Typhoon Haiyan. Around 33,000 children are being vaccinated against measles and polio, starting in evacuation centres in the city of Tacloban and other devastated areas. The World Health Organization, which is coordinating the campaign, says children who have been made homeless or are living in temporary shelter are at particular risk of contracting infectious diseases. Tarek Yasarovic is a spokesman for the WHO in Tacloban.
Measles is a viral infection that can spread very fast among children, and especially in these kind of settings where people really live in a crowded living conditions. We are also providing vitamin A. We need to strengthen the immune system of children. The access to clean water is still a big challenge here.
US President Barack Obama has defended the interim agreement on Iran's nuclear program reached in Geneva on Sunday. The six-month deal saw Iran agree to curb some of its nuclear activities in return for limited sanctions relief. Though widely welcomed, the deal is opposed by Israel and Saudi Arabia. Mr. Obama acknowledged that obstacles remained, but said tough talk and bluster by US politicians did not guarantee American security.
Over the coming months, we're going to continue our diplomacy with the goal of achieving a comprehensive solution that deals with the threat of Iran's nuclear program once and for all. And if Iran seizes this opportunity and chooses to join the global community, then we can begin to chip away at the mistrust that's existed for many, many years between our two nations.
The Scottish Government will today unveil its vision for the future if voters in Scotland vote to leave the United Kingdom in an independence referendum next year. The 670-page blueprint document is expected to focus on answering questions the ruling Scottish National Party has been accused of avoiding, especially on the economic consequences of independence. The United States has condemned recent acts of violence in Northern Ireland and reiterated its continued support for those working to build a stronger society and an enduring peace. The statement from the US State Department followed the discovery of a bomb that partially exploded inside a hijacked vehicle in Belfast city centre on Sunday night. The European Investment Bank has agreed in principle to provide significant financial backing for the Lewis Cross City Link in Dublin. Negotiations will start in the coming days and are expected to be finalised early next year. The estimated cost of linking the red and green lines in the capital is €368 million. Transport Minister Leo Varadkar has said that if funding is secured from the European Investment Bank, it would be at a competitive rate. A man in his early 20s was killed in a single vehicle road crash near Garristown in North County Dublin last night. He was a passenger in a car that crashed into a tree at Baldwinstown Cross at about 9:30. The driver was uninjured. And now the time is coming up to 8:06. Remaining patches of fog and frost will clear to give a dry, rather cloudy day with occasional bright or short sunny spells. Highs temperatures 7 to 10 degrees.
8:08 and here with It Says in the Papers once again is Deirdre Purcell.
The lead story in the Irish Times tells us that all college graduates from universities and institutes of technology are to have votes in the Shannon elections, and that the two existing three-seat constituencies will be replaced by one six-seater. And as you heard in the bulletin, along with the Times, the Irish Independent and Irish Examiner all published this year's school league tables today. The lead piece for the Irish Independent is that most of the people who have had deals with banks processed by personal insolvency specialists are families within the PAYE sector. We're told that most manage to keep their homes and that many have been allowed to keep their health insurance and second cars. The main story for the Irish Daily Mail is that Ciara Quinn, daughter of businessman Sean Quinn and her husband Niall McPartland, who are allowed €8,000 per month for themselves and their three children, yesterday asked the commercial court that €10,000 be released from frozen family assets in order to pay a mixture of income tax and residential property tax. And the Examiner leads with a story covered widely this morning. Charles Allen, leader of what is described as a mysterious private trust. The Rodolphus Allen Private Family Trust has attracted thousands of indebted homeowners, business people and developers who paid fees to join on foot of promises that it could help prevent repossession of their properties. Mr. Allen was arrested at Lottermore House in Cork City. An independent front page story tells us that Operation Bambi, which, as you've just heard about in the programme earlier, it's called an operation against deer poaching, launched by Gardaí with the cooperation of the National Parks and Wildlife Service. It has succeeded in arresting three men in their 20s, all in County Carlow. One suspect apparently used Facebook to boast that Gardaí wouldn't catch him, even though he had killed 15 deer in one night. Poachers with an eye on the Christmas venison market have been known, we're told, to use an electronic device imitating the call of a stag during the rutting season to tempt stags out of cover. When they emerge, they're shot from the roadside with high-powered rifles. That story is also covered in The Examiner, with Ed Carty telling us that during a wider investigation into such poaching, as well as guns, silencers were recovered in one case, and one man was found with 24 shot deer in his van. And Operation Bambi continues. Now, hold the phone. Engineers at Lockheed Martin in the US have revealed they're developing a plane that can fly at Mach 6, three times as fast as Concorde. At present, it's to be a spy plane, but predictably, they're getting excited about the possibilities inherent, for instance, in passengers, when flights from the UK, say to New York, will take an hour, and London-Tokyo will take two. It's going to be a long time before that comes on stream, however, not least until tests on the skin of the aircraft, made from titanium crystals wrapped in carbon fibre, can be proven to withstand the heat generated at such speeds, and until the extent of the sonic boom it will create, said to be strong enough to bring down buildings, can be ameliorated. That's from Tom Leonard in the Mail. Swiss voters have rejected a proposal to limit executives' pay to 12 times that of junior explorers. Junior employers. The measure was opposed by 65% of voters, and the turnout at 53% was the highest in 3 years. The president of the Swiss Employers Association called the result a big relief and a signal that it's not up to the state to have a say in pay. And finally, a piece by Katrina Murphy in today's farming supplement in The Independent tells us that in the near future, Irish motorists could be filling their fuel tanks with fuel made from farm slurry, silage and sea lettuce. Read all about it in The Independent's farming supplement.
Deirdre, thank you very much. 12 minutes past eight. In a moment, paying for Dublin's new Lewis. Welcome back. You're listening to Morning Ireland at 14 minutes past eight. Look down the river from O'Connell Bridge in Dublin and you'll see the new bridge which is being built for the new Lewis line, and if you go up Dominic Street as I happened to do yesterday, you'll see the work already started on this line which will link the Maynooth railway line at Cabra with Phibsborough and the city centre, crossing the other two railway lines, continuing the other Lewis line and continuing on to Stephen's Green. The question is, how is it going to be paid for? The total bill is estimated at the moment at €368 million. The completion date, by the way, is the end of 2017. Leo Varadkar, Minister for Transport, Tourism and Sport, joins us. Minister, good morning and thanks for coming in.
Morning.
This is all about borrowing from the European Investment Bank. So is the deal done?
Yes, it is. The board of the European Investment Bank has endorsed the Lewis Cross City project and has agreed to provide a low interest loan to Ireland to help fund the cost of construction. They're willing to make up to €163 million available, which is roughly half the cost of the project. And in general, EIB interest rates are about 1% lower than the rate that the government would otherwise get on the market. So that means significant savings over the next couple of years.
What will the interest rate be?
The interest rate isn't actually agreed yet, but the general principle is that the EIB funds half the cost of a project if they endorse it, and do so at a rate about 1% lower than the market rate at the time. So if you figure 1% of 160 million is 1.6 million, but if that was over 20 years, you'd be talking savings of over 30 million in the service costs of the project.
This will run across the city centre. It will link the red and the green lines. But 368 million, are you still totally convinced that given the state of the country, we can afford this?
I am, and I think it may even come in a little bit lower than that, but I suppose we won't know that until 2017 or 2018. There'll be 800 jobs created in construction, 60 when it's finished. But it's not just about linking the existing Lewis lines or even linking Lewis to the commuter rail network, which it will do. It really transforms rail-based public transport in the greater Dublin area. So it'll make all sorts of journeys possible that aren't possible now. So just to give you two examples, for example, you could get on the train in Maynooth or Leixlip and get out in Dundrum Shopping Centre. You'll be able to get on the Lewis and Houston Station, get out at Trinity College, take the Lewis from Sandyford to the O2. So it'll add about 8 to 10 million journeys per year to the rail network. And in addition to that, we'll take about 3 million car journeys off the roads. And that's really significant. You know, you could take half the railway network in the rest of the country. Wouldn't do that.
Have you any reason to think that the headaches for retailers who are affected when the roadworks entered their street will be any less than they were for the previous two lines, when it caused a lot of unhappiness and disruption?
Yeah, I do. We've built two Lewis lines already, one extension and one spur. So a lot has been learned from the first time it was done. There will be disruption, no doubt about that, but the city will stay open for business. At the moment, this week, there are information meetings with businesses north and south of the Liffey. I chair a group which involves the key business interests, just to make sure that there's, you know, a minister on top of this. Next week, we'll open an office in the Royal Hibernian Way, just off Grafton Street, and that's a public information office where people can come in and see the plans, have someone to talk to if there's something wrong. So we're doing really everything we can to minimise the disruption, but there will be some disruption, there's no denying that.
Just before we leave this subject, there is talk now, another cheaper metro system being on offer. Is there any point in even thinking about it?
Not really. I suppose, first of all, for two reasons, is that we don't have the money at the moment to build an underground railway. We'll look at that again in 2015 with a view to the next plan in 2017. But, you know, there are a lot of railway enthusiasts out there, and there are loads of people who will come to you. I used to meet them all in the first year. I don't anymore. But there are loads of people who come to you promising you that they can, you know, build an underground metro for you at twice, at half the cost and twice the time. When you actually ask them to stand over their own figures, they generally can't do it. And, you know, it's realistic projects with realistic costings that I'm interested in.
Looking to the more immediate future, we end the Troika's period of rule on the 15th of December, and as things stand, it looks like the power will be switched off the day after the 16th of December, with the ESB Group of Unions starting their industrial action from then. Now, we've had David Fitzsimons from Retail Excellence Ireland in earlier saying that this is, well, criticising unions for, as he puts it, not being in the same world as everybody else. He says that the government should respond to this with legislation to prevent or ban industrial action which could have such a devastating effect on the economy.
Well, I think, first of all, this seems to me to be a very unnecessary dispute. There are a lot of pension funds in Ireland that are in trouble. The ESB pension fund is not one of them. According to the pension fund, pensions board rather, it's fully funded up until 2018 and would actually be in surplus after that. There was a deal done a couple of years ago whereby the company injected a couple of hundred million into the pension scheme. And that's money that could have come to us as shareholders and taxpayers. And also the workers agreed to take a reduction in the benefits they thought they were
going
to get.
There's still a hole in the fund.
There is, but you know, almost every second the defined benefit pension scheme has a deficit in at the moment. But what you have to do is agree a funding plan that will bring it back to financial health, and that's been agreed in the case of ESB. So what this is a dispute over the accounting treatment of it, whether it's a DB scheme in the accounts or a DC scheme in the accounts. So nobody's job is being threatened here, nobody's being asked to take an additional pay cut, and nobody's pension is under threat. So, you know, it seems to me that this rush into industrial action really is unnecessary and unwarranted. Now, I do welcome the fact that the unions and the management are going to talk this week, but hopefully they can agree some sort of process that will allow them to lift this threat on people running into Christmas, which is totally unnecessary in my view.
Could you see the idea of legislation which David Fitzsimons says should be considered at least to ban strikes on a utility that could cause such havoc?
Well, that does exist in some countries where there's an essential public service. There can be a legislative strike ban, but that usually is linked to something else. It's linked to a sort of labour court process. So, for example, before someone could go on strike, they would have to go to the labour court, or in some cases, they would have to accept that the labour court's recommendation is binding. It's also in other countries linked to legislation that underlines the right of people to join a union and be represented by their union, which is the right to collective bargaining. So I don't know if the government's going to want to go down that route, but if we did, I don't think you could do it in a draconian way that would just take away the rights of workers to withdraw their labour without having some sort of mechanism that they would be able to have their rights protected. And usually that's done through an established right to collective bargaining, and in addition to that a labour court or a sort of judicial process that would then be binding on both sides.
If a strike goes ahead, it will look terrible as well as feeling terrible. It was out of the Troika one day and then National Power strikes the next.
Yeah, well, it may well look terrible, but it's not how it would look that really bothers me. It's the impact on businesses, on schools, on primary healthcare centres, for example, and then just on households and families. So, like I say, this to me seems like an unnecessary dispute and an unreasonable threat. No one's job is being threatened. No one is being asked to take an additional pay cut, and no one's pension is under threat. So, really, I'd like to see both sides step back from the brink and engage with each other in the week ahead.
All right, Minister, thank you. By the way, the Irish Times reporting this morning that, as promised by the Taoiseach, we're going to see very soon legislation to implement the referendum in 1979 on a Seanad vote for all graduates of all third-level colleges, which is grand but very limited. Is that, are we going to see any other reform in the lifetime of this government, given that the people have voted to keep the Seanad?
Well, I think it's very important to say that that's just the first step, and it's a small first step to reforming the Seanad, and the Taoiseach's made that very clear. Changing anything else is going to require consensus, and that's always been the problem with reform of the Seanad. Everybody wants it in theory. When they look at the different proposals, there really isn't a consensus behind any of them. Changing the Taoiseach's nominees, for example, would require another referendum. Getting rid of the five rather antediluvian panels that date back to the 1930s, that would require another referendum as well. So I think what we'd have to really do is find a consensus around how we can reform
the other
ways of doing
it. There's a fair amount that can be done without a referendum.
Well, I'm not sure there really is. Like people say, for example, you know, opening up the five panels to the general franchise. But when you actually think and work that out in practice, it's extremely difficult to do that. And the panels are totally out of date. You know, if you take, for example, that there's, you know, a panel for agriculture, but not one for the technology industry now, which in modern Ireland is surely just as important. There's a panel for education and culture, but none for sport or tourism. You know, so a lot of these things, none for health, for example. A lot of these things, you know, if we're going to try reform the Senate, let's try and get a consensus around what people want that reform to be.
Leo Varadkar, Minister, thank you very much. 8:23.
Charles Allen Sr., the anti-eviction activist whose trust accepted contributions from indebted property owners, was arrested yesterday on foot of a bench warrant. He was found after being confronted by a journalist from the Irish Examiner newspaper at a property in County Cork, who subsequently made inquiries to the Gardaí. Well, that journalist was Conor Ryan. He's on the phone. Conor, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Now, quite a splash on your front page this morning in relation to this investigation by you and the subsequent arrest. Can you first of all tell us a little bit about the background of Charles Allen Sr.?
I suppose Charles Allen Sr. came to prominence probably about June, when a trust that he had set up early in the year really started to pick up members. It spread by word of mouth across the country, and people, and not just people, I suppose, with houses or small holdings, but developers with sometimes more than 100 million euro worth of debt, of very large debt, decided to put their assets into this trust in the belief that by doing so and paying a small fee for doing it, that there was somehow a secret formula that had been found that would allow them to defeat their mortgages, and therefore they would be able to keep their assets.
Now, this was the Rodolphus Allen Private Family Trust, but things unravelled.
Things have unravelled, because on each occasion when it's actually been tested, it's fallen in the courts. And what actually happened in July was, instead of the promise of going into court and revealing a foolproof legal strategy, it opted to seize a stud farm in Kildare by force, and twice in the space of a week ousted the receivers from Eugene McDermott's Kenniscourt stud farm in Kildare. On the second occasion, I think, like, judging by the pictures, there were more than 200 people there, and they had a motorcade across with the console across the country and ousted the receivers. Now, that led to allegations of trespass. Charlie Allen, the political activist Ben Gilroy, and the owner of the stud farm, Eugene McDermott, were all summoned to appear in court. There was initially trouble serving the summons on Charlie Allen, but it was eventually served. However, he didn't appear in court and instead opted to set up a newry. So on foot of that and his refusal to answer the summons, the judge issued a bench warrant for his arrest.
Now, it's worth pointing out before we go on that Mr. McDermott has subsequently purged his contempt.
Last week, on Thursday of last week, Eugene McDermott appeared before the High Court. He apologised for what happened. He purged his contempt,
okay,
and the judge accepted that. In relation to Ben Gilroy's contempt, there's a hearing due on that. He disputes how the summons was served, or the legitimacy of the summons, and that dispute is scheduled for hearing in January.
So take us back to Charles Allen then, because he's in Newry now with a summons where the warrant can't be executed.
At that stage, we approached him in Newry, where his business had stopped. It had been operating in Cork, where it was signing in new properties. People were paying 200, 300 euro a property to get into the trust, plus leasing it back for additional money per property. Then he moved to Wicklow because the solicitor, the notary public in Cork, pulled his services from the trust. He moved to Wicklow initially. We tracked him down there. Then he moved to Newry because obviously the bench warrant couldn't be enforced. At that stage when we confronted him, he said it was nobody's business, and certainly not the business of a sad little paper, to ask him where he would go.
So the sad little paper fought back.
Well, we continued to receive tip-offs, and then it became evident that he had come back into the south. Now, the bench warrant was with Thomastown Garda Station in Kilkenny, but I didn't hear any evidence that he was in Kilkenny or certainly around his old home in Ishtig. But we did hear tip-offs of him being in other parts of the country. And then yesterday morning, we got a tip-off that one of the properties that had been put into the trust that was supposed to be developed for a hotel, but, you know, stopped mid-development and it's just a boarded up period residence now, that he had moved into that, and it's my understanding that he was actually hoping to set up his corporate headquarters at Lotamore House in Cork.
And you confronted him yesterday following a tip-off in an outbuilding, was it, the pile, as it were?
There was a 210-year-old very large residence and an overgrown 11-acre property, but at the back of that there was some work in terms of dry lining and doing up some of the outbuildings for use. Obviously there were big plans for that particular property during the boom, but nothing has been done with it. So myself and my colleague Vincent Ryan confronted him. There were electrical men connecting the wires. He had a caravan in the yard, and he had at least one other person with him who we didn't see. He called out to, but we didn't see.
And reading through your article, he clearly wasn't interested in talking to you, so what happened next?
Well, he threatened to call the guards. I suppose we just had a bit of a discussion. He kind of then made to escort us off the property. We put a number of questions to him. He didn't answer them. We refused to leave the property. So at that point, it was either him called the guards or us. So we called the guards. We checked that there was a bench warrant, that they hadn't been executed at the court. It was rightly informed last Friday. That was correct. So the guards acting on the bench warrant that had been out since September the 27th came, and after a lengthy discussion, arrested him. Unfortunately, there wasn't a sitting of the High Court. They wouldn't have made Dublin yesterday evening. So Charles Annan was in custody overnight and will appear this morning in the High Court in Dublin.
An interesting tale with further developments, no doubt, today. We'll leave it there, but thank you very much for that. That's Conor Ryan of the Irish Examiner newspaper on that tale in relation to Charles Annan.
Morning Ireland at 25 to 9. Darren Maloney's back with more sport.
Cathal, good morning. Aston Villa came from 2-0 down to draw 2-2 with West Brom at the Hawthorns last night in the West Midlands Derby in the Premier League. Republic of Ireland striker Shane Long scored both West Brom goals inside the first 11 minutes to put the home team in a commanding position. But the Villa manager Paul Lambert made a triple substitution after an hour with his team 2 down, and that brought Villa to life. El Amadi got their first goal after 67 minutes and Westwood equalised with 14 minutes to go. This was the reaction afterwards of Shane Long of West Brom.
We put ourselves in a great position to go on and win the game, and you know, after that first half performance, I thought all I could see was a third and a fourth goal coming, but fair play to Aston Villa, they kept plugging away, and you know, after they got that first goal, they put us under serious pressure, and you know, disappointing to only come out with a point, but you know, we'd have to learn from this.
And the Aston Villa boss Paul Lambert felt their comeback was not just down to the changes he made.
Sometimes you get games like that unintentionally. You have every bit of intention to go out there and try and win a game, but we're 2-0 down after 10 minutes. The first goal was really poor. It's a long ball, it should never travel the distance that it did, and to pull it down and still do it, it was a good goal for their point of view. Second goal is a mistake from Leo, and sometimes that puts you in the back foot. But we kept on hanging in, we had a bit of the ball, so it wasn't as if a game was back to the wall stuff.
The 2-2 draw leaves Villa and West Brom level on 15 points, and Villa have now saved 7 points from losing positions so far this season. Staying with soccer, Celtic, Chelsea and Arsenal are all in Champions League action tonight on match day 5. Chelsea are top of Group E, they're away to third place Basel. Arsenal in Group F host the bottom side Marseille, but we're going to focus on Celtic and their meeting with AC Milan at Parkhead. The Celtic manager Neil Lennon says this is win or bust for his team. They begin the evening bottom of Group H. We're delighted this morning to be joined from Glasgow by Roddy Forsyth. Hi, Roddy.
Good morning to you.
Neil Lennon in very relaxed mood at their press conference last night. He says they're going to go for it because that's their way, and, well, they have to.
Yes, I think that's the only approach he can adopt. The group is still open to what he calls a flip. Barcelona have qualified for the last 16 of the Champions League, although they haven't yet won the group. But it's everything to play for with the other three teams. Celtic must win, however, and if they do that, they will guarantee themselves European football after Christmas, but probably in the Europa League. They would still require a combination of results in the final game to see them through to the Champions League, but it is there to be accomplished.
Mm. Now, Milan's form will be a source of encouragement to Celtic fans. In their league, they're 4 points off the drop zone. They haven't won in their last three Champions League matches. What's up with them, Roddy?
Well, they're just imploding at the moment. Look at the names in their side, Balotelli, Kaká and others. And yet, they haven't won away from home this season. They are 13th in Serie A. They've certainly tumbled in their fans' estimation. As I don't doubt you know, there's a mob of fans barricaded them into the stadium the other night until the goalkeeper and Kaká came out and said that they would heed what the fans were saying. They were trying, and they asked the fans to get on side with them. But the manager's under severe pressure, and yet, as I said to Neil Lennon yesterday, if you had to pick a single game to turn your fortunes round, it would be a Champions League game. And if Arsenal, Milan know that if they win, then they will qualify for the last 16. So you really can see that there's a great deal to be played for in this game. Although I think a European night in the East End of Glasgow, high octane, with the crowd going full pelt, I think Milan may not find it just the refuge they hope it will be.
Mm. What's your feeling, Roddy? Will Celtic do it? Will Anthony Stokes play, by the way?
I don't think so. I think the team will be Forrest, Commons and Boracter as the three behind Samaras, Commons directly behind him, and I think Stokes will likely be on the bench to be brought on if that doesn't succeed.
Mm. And to finish, Roddy, let's have a word or two about Arsenal. That group with Napoli and Dortmund, very, very tight. Arsene Wenger feels that Marseille, that they're still threatening even though they're bottom of the table. They've lost all four games.
Yes, and with a goal difference of -6, makes you wonder why he does say that. Then you look at Arsenal's record in the Champions League. They've lost three of their last five home games, and that's not a group that's going to be decided tonight, except for there's one combination of results that would put Arsenal into the last 16, but they really need Borussia Dortmund to lose, and that's something you wouldn't bet on at the moment, even though Borussia Dortmund are hardly having the best of seasons.
Roddy, thanks for your time this morning. That's Roddy Forsyth joining us live from Glasgow. Staying with soccer, Tommy Dunn has been appointed manager of Galway Football Club as it enters the Airtricity League next season. In rugby, Rory Best could face a race against time to be fit for the start of the Six Nations due to the broken arm he sustained in Sunday's defeat to New Zealand. He fractured the radius bone in his right arm. He's expected to be out for at least 6 weeks. He's almost certain to miss Ulster's Heineken Cup pool matches in December and January. And the Six Nations, remember, starts for Ireland against Scotland on the 2nd of February. In Gaelic Games, Pat Flanagan is the new manager of the Sligo Senior Footballers. The former Westmeath boss takes over from Kevin Walsh, and five-time All-Star Sean Kavanagh will captain Tyrone in 2014. He takes over from Stephen O'Neill, who led the team for the past 2 years. Finally, in athletics, the reigning champion Fionnuala Britton heads the 30-strong Irish team for next month's European Cross Country Championships in Belgrade. Britton and Sarah Tracy are the only members of the gold medal team who are returning to defend that title. Inter-counties champion Paul Pollock leads a men's team which includes brothers Michael and Dan Mulhare, along with Joe Sweeney, David McCarthy and Stephen Scullion. That's the sport.
Dara, thank you very much. 9 minutes to nine. Back to these league tables, which appear in several of the newspapers this morning, showing by percentage for each individual school the level of third level entry, and showing, as we've heard, that the number of schools from which all Leaving Cert students progress to third level education is continuing to rise, and that pupils from fee-paying schools and Gaelscoileann in particular are claiming the majority of places on courses with the highest points, courses like medicine, dentistry, law and teacher training. Now, one of the groups opposed to these league tables, or opposed, certainly pointing out the damage in their view, which they do, is the Teachers Union of Ireland, whose General Secretary John McGowan is on the line now. John, good morning.
Good morning, Carl.
I see from your press statement that you say the publication of these lists inevitably leads to unfair comparison that is hugely damaging to the inclusive school that admits all children of the community. Are you opposed to the publication of these tables and the making available of this information completely?
Well, two things about that. First and foremost, the tables are themselves a distortion, a distraction as well. Had the newspapers wished to publish lists of schools in alphabetical order, indicating, giving the information that they do. It would be an exercise in silliness, but it moves from being an exercise in silliness to something damaging when they order them in ranking order, because that purports then to make judgments about schools. And the problem with that is that there are children, students, who are completely ignored by these tables. There are children, students, whose achievement in second level is absolutely remarkable. Students with special educational needs, students from international communities whose mother tongue isn't English, students from families where there is no prior record of progress through second level, much less to third level. And this absolutely ignores a segment of our population.
And that's a view that you've expressed before. But what I want to be clear on is that I know you say the way in which these figures are, but which are, broadly speaking, accurate. You say they're a distortion and a distraction. But are you opposed to the making available of this information at all, or just critical of the media presentation of them?
Well, no, we have no particular difficulty with information being made available, provided it is contextualised. And if this information were contextualised, it would be a different matter entirely.
Now, given that it is dealing with a matter of fact, which is a narrow issue, but nevertheless one that concerns parents, you have to ask the question, what's the harm if parents want to know this information? And I suggest most of them do, then shouldn't they have it?
Well, the point is that they already know it about their individual schools. What this does is it purports to show, if you like, differentiated achievement levels between schools, which takes absolutely... It tells people what they already know. And it also...
Can I suggest to you that that's absolutely not the case? There are, to take the example of County Cork, there are about 80 second level schools, and parents faced with a choice of four or five or more schools, some of them a minority fee-paying in County Cork and Cork City, the others not fee-paying, they don't have information about the third level rate of entry.
But I'd submit to you, Cahill, that they do. What this tells
us... Where would they get it?
It tells us what we already know. It is, first and foremost, it's available directly from the school.
Yeah, that's if you go around to school. But the advantage, surely, of this information is it's there in the newspaper, and you can go down through the entire list and make up your own mind without having to ring around or look up websites.
Well, Grainne Fallor actually has an extremely important piece in today's Times. It's on page 15. It has nothing whatsoever to do with the feeder school lists. What it has to do is the selection of a second-level school by parents, and it gives the rounded, contextualised way in which parents need to consider what school is appropriate for their child, given that child's particular needs and talents. That's the really important piece in today's papers. What these figures tell us is what we already know. It is that wealth counts, and it is more particularly that poverty damages life chances. And if the policymakers are to make anything of this, and I heard Catherine Donnelly this morning mention that this is really something designed as much for policymakers as for parents, it is that we must, as a society, tackle the very, very source of educational disadvantage, not just within schools, but within the communities that are served by schools.
All right. John McGowan, General Secretary of the TUI, thank you very much for talking to us. 14 minutes to 9.
And Extravision is coming in for criticism this morning for telling customers who've pre-ordered the new €500-a-throw Xbox One games console they must also buy an additional game when they come to collect their unit. National Consumer Agency says it's talking to Extravision. Now, they're not with us this morning, but we are joined in studio, though, by RTE business reporter Adam Maguire. Adam, turning into quite a fuss, this. What's it all about?
Well, ultimately, when these big game consoles come out, people will go into shops months in advance, maybe, and put down a deposit or even pay the whole price in advance in order to ensure that they get one on release, because they're generally very limited.
Limited supply.
Exactly, yeah. So what seems to have happened is Extravision customers went in to pick up their Xbox One, and they were told, well, you can't just take the Xbox One, you also have to buy a game with it, which the games are about 65 to 70 euro, although they do bundle deals, so it's about €40 extra in Extravision. Said you cannot take your Xbox One home with you unless you also pay for this game on top of that.
So this is more than heavy persuasion.
Well, it's they're basically what they are saying is you're more than entitled to get your refund on your pre-order if you like, but that means that you're going to have a very hard time finding an Xbox One anywhere else. The problem, of course, is that customers are saying they weren't told this in advance when they went in and they made this pre-order, and when they actually, you know, paid their deposit or paid the money over. These things tend to be very informal. You go up and you basically get a receipt to say that you've paid your deposit. You get your name put down the list, so it's not like you're signing a big contract.
And of course, it is a much desired gift for Christmas.
Absolutely, and if you don't have something pre-ordered, it's going to be very difficult for you to get an Xbox One before Christmas.
So what's the National Consumer Agency saying? Because there is a Sale of Goods Act, isn't there? I mean, there must be some sort of protections here for customers.
Yeah, well, I mean, they've said that they have had contact from customers and relationists. They're talking to Xtrusion. They say, in general, though, that if a customer is pre-ordered to pay a deposit or paid in full for a product in advance, that they're entitled to get that from the retailer. They've entered a contract with the retailer, and you cannot add preconditions after the fact. You know, if you've agreed in advance that you're just, this is a pre-order for a certain thing, you have to follow through on that.
It sounds a little bit like, in business terms, a kind of an inventory management exercise. They have so many games, they need to shift the games as well as the consoles.
Well, I mean, the issue with it is that a lot of these things, you would sell a game with it anyway. If you're buying a new console,
well, that does strike you as common sense. Yeah,
yeah, that you'd pick something up so you can play it at the same time. The problem is, of course, even if you were intending on buying something yourself, being strong-armed into having to buy it maybe isn't going to leave a particularly good taste in your mouth at the end of it. It does seem to be to ensure, you know, the reason why they bundle these things is to get a bit extra on top of each sale.
And Xtrusion themselves, have they been able to provide any explanation?
We've tried contacting them yesterday and today as well, left a number of messages with them, and they haven't responded yet, so there's no comment from them on the matter so far.
They'll also be selling the PlayStation 4, the rival console product, if you like. Is there a similar caveat on that?
It seems to be that the caveat won't apply to the PlayStation 4, so if you've got a pre-order for one of those with Xtrusion, you'll be able to go in and just pick up the console itself.
Any end in sight to this?
Well, it really depends on what comes out from the National Consumer Agency, and obviously they're going to be talking with Xtrusion, and you'd hope that they'll be able to find some kind of resolution in the near future.
RTE business journalist Adam Maguire, thank you for joining us in studio. 9 minutes to 9 o'clock on Morning Ireland. The Bishop of Cork and Ross, Dr. John Buckley, is distancing himself today from comments made at a funeral in the diocese during last week. The priest at the funeral had apparently asked mourners to pray that former Lord Mayor of Cork, John Murray, be found not guilty on sex assault charges. Now, Murray was subsequently convicted last Friday in the Circuit Court in Cork. The priest's comments were made prior to the jury returning its verdict. Ralph Regal from the Irish Independent is on the line. Ralph, what can you tell us about what... Owen English from the Examiner, apologies, is on the line. Owen, what can you tell us about what transpired in the court? At this funeral mass?
Well, as you said, Christopher, what arose in the funeral mass was that a visiting priest from the diocese, a priest who isn't serving in the Diocese of Cork and Ross, asked mourners during the funeral to pray last Thursday that former Lord Mayor John Murray be found not guilty. And as you said, the jury returned on Friday with the guilty verdict. But callers to our local radio station, Cork 96 FM, yesterday raised concerns that the priest had used the pulpit to effectively ask people to pray for a not guilty verdict in such a high-profile trial. Now, we contacted the Diocese of Cork and Ross yesterday, and as you said, Dr. John Buckley issued a statement later distancing himself from the comments and making it very clear that the priest who had asked people to for these prayers was in fact a visiting priest to the diocese. He said that the comments from the pulpit were offensive and entirely inappropriate. We made our own inquiries last night and established that the priest who had asked people for this prayer was a visiting Augustinian friar, and I spoke to the provincial last night, Father John Henry, and he said that the order was very keen to acknowledge its responsibility in this matter and that they were taking it very seriously. He said that the prayer was wholly inappropriate, and he accepted that the intervention by the friar had caused great distress. He said that he had discussed the matter with the priest in question, and he said that that priest now accepts that what he had said on the altar last Thursday had caused great upset and offence to the people who were in the church.
And is there any explanation as to how the priest, who hasn't been named in this instance, came to make such extraordinary comments during, I think, the prayers for the intercession?
No, we didn't get an explanation yesterday. I suppose perhaps just an appalling lack of judgment, I suppose, is the only conclusion you can come to. We do know that the priest was a friend of the family of the deceased man whose funeral was being celebrated last Thursday, and that he was also a friend of the family of John Murray. But the fact that he took the opportunity at a funeral to ask people for this prayer is what has caused such offence. And Father John Hennery, the provincial of the Augustinians, said that they are taking the matter very seriously. He said that in his capacity as provincial, he is taking full responsibility for it. He said that the order is now conducting its own internal investigation and that the priest may face further sanctions.
Owen English of the Irish Examiner, we leave it there, but thank you very much for joining us on the line this morning.
Hedges are a national asset and they need protection and they need the raising of awareness, not just from farmers. This is the view of Woodlands of Ireland, which is a not-for-profit company with charitable status, which raises public awareness of our native woodlands through a variety of projects. And one of them is going to be launched today, which is a national database. To tell us more, we're joined by Dr. Declan Little, ecologist and project manager with Woodlands of Ireland. Good morning and welcome.
Morning, Colin.
First of all, why do hedges matter?
Well, hedges have a range of functions, have enormous value, not just in terms of biodiversity and wildlife, but also they were primarily established to provide stock proofing for cattle and sheep, for livestock. Most of them created around 300 years ago during the Enclosure Acts. So they have a function as well as having visual qualities and aesthetic qualities in our landscape.
Now, the database will tell what to whom?
Well, the database will be accessible to the general public and to professionals who survey hedgerows and who manage hedgerows. So basically anyone can access the database and find out about hedgerows in their area. There are about 15 county hedgerow surveys carried out over the last 15 years and all the data from those surveys are in the database.
And that will be on a website which you can tell us about when we finish. You are concerned, it's not just about farmers, but you are obviously concerned about what farmers do to hedges. And this, what we often see is tractors going along beside a hedge and hacking away at it.
Yeah,
that gives you nightmares?
Yeah, well, it's more that hedgerows really aren't afforded much protection. They have under, we say, the Habitats Directive or the Wildlife Act. They don't. So their management really requires skillful techniques in order to ensure their long term viability and survival.
I can hear a farmer saying, "I don't have the time."
Yes, and this is the trouble with modern life. It's very difficult to get the time to manage a hedgerow properly to ensure that it will survive. Well, what we're saying is like that under, for example, the agricultural schemes like REFS and AOS, that there is an opportunity there to provide farmers with the finance to manage their hedge in a way that is far better than just flailing them.
Is this a job for every farmer? Or there is a Hedge Laying Association of Ireland. These are specialists?
These are specialists in the area of management and providing the training for people to be able to manage their hedges properly. So there is the infrastructure there in order for us to manage hedges properly. And it's a case really of providing the funding, which is there under various agricultural schemes over the years.
So it's not a matter of money, you're saying?
Not really. It's a case of a commitment, really, to put in place the finance under the environmental and the agricultural schemes in order to do it.
So as opposed to a tractor going along and doing very quickly the job of trimming a hedge, mm-hmm. what would a hedge that's managed properly look like and how would it be different?
Well, typically what's done is a hedge is laid. You cut through the stems of the hedge, you bend over the branches and you bind them together into a very formidable stock-proof barrier.
Apart from farmers, is this awareness campaign aimed at anybody else in particular that can make a difference, as opposed to most of us who just look at them?
Well, it's very important in terms of how our landscape looks. Ireland has the least wooded landscape in Europe at 1.5% in terms of woodland, but hedgerows make up another 1.5% of our landscape. So it's very important that policymakers and the general public value hedges, because for our tourist industry, for example, hedges are an important part of what people see when they come here.
All right, so if you want to know more, the place to go is where? Online?
Well, if you want to go, have a look at the website at www.biodiversityireland.ie.
All right, and that'll be live later today.
That'll be live later today. We're launching today in the Royal Irish Academy, the National Hedgerow Database.
Well, Dr. Declan Little, thank you very much for coming in to tell us about it. 2 minutes to 9.